Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy.
One of my favourite albums growing up was Performance, Rockin' the Fillmore, which was Humble Pie's double live album. And Martin and I just played it to death.
Do you know what, Gary? Yeah. Our listeners, a lot of them, are going to know that because you have actually referenced it a few times.
Well, I have. And also because we had Peter Frampton on, right? Who plays on
that's
that.
Right. That's right. He was the first one. And you love doing that line from it. It's been a gas, whatever.
Yes. We go home on Monday, but I want to tell you, it's really been a gas this time.
And I've got to say, I went back and listened to it a couple of days ago. It is magnificent.
It really is. I mean, some of the swing that band had as well.
Yeah.
And some of the extended stuff like Walk on Gilded Splinters, taking up a whole of one side. I mean, it's technically brilliant, but yeah, at the same time, you know, full of gusto and, you know, takes you back to what it must have been like in that New York venue back in 1972 or whenever it was. So we've got Jerry Shirley on, who is one of the few surviving members of Humble Pie and played with Humble Pie all the way through. But he also
He did all sorts of things. He was in Waystar with Pete Way and Fast Eddie from Motorhead. Of course, famously, was on Sid Barrett's last two albums.
Only two albums, I think, wasn't it? I mean,
And played. It was only complete. But where he started, though, is fantastic. We don't want to give too much away.
No, but he also, he played at one of the only live Sid Barrett shows at Olympia.
That's right. It says the Olympia. I mean, is that Olympia?
Yeah.
Because that's huge.
No, but it wasn't just... It was a night of festivities. It was one of those kind of hangs. And I think it was called something like the Extravagant Fashion Festival. I mean, we'll ask Jerry. And lots of bands played. I mean, you know, obviously Coliseum, because they played at all those things. And I think, you know, Status Quo played there and Black Sabbath. And, you know, it was a tune-in, turn-on, drop-out sort of evening, day.
Well, which is very much what Sid did, isn't it? Because he walked off halfway through the fourth number.
That's right. Anyway, I think Jerry's got tons of stories about...
He has. I've met Jerry in the past and he's a lovely fella.
So we're going to do Sid and we're going to do Humble Pie. Let's get him on.
Yeah, and the apostolic convention.
That's easy for you to say. Is that a saint? An apostle?
Well, it's apostles, isn't it? It's to do with apostles.
An intervention. Exactly what we need right now, right? Because we can't... Oh, yes, sir. Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
But it's a big tune, for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them, and they've been really good, man. I've been sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you, guys, for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah. It's
get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Hey! Okay. Hallelujah!
Hello, mate.
I have to be honest with you because I did a little bit of research. I knew you guys were North Londoners, or Gary anyway, but this is where I'm from.
Oh, no. He holds up a Spurs.
So, I guess we'll get beyond that because we both had a bit of a pick up this season, wouldn't you say?
Well, we're in Champions League, Jerry.
Yeah, you are in the Champions League for the first time in a little while.
Oh, it's going to get bitter and twisted. So soon. Thanks for doing this.
This is great. I was shocked and amazed that you asked me, really, to be honest.
No, well, you shouldn't be. Jerry, I was looking for you at the Sid Barrett movie screening. I couldn't see you.
I was there. I saw a bunch of people I hadn't seen in literally 50 years, almost. And I got there late anyway, but the person that... I was there with my ex and John Hamill, our old roadie, who went on to work with McCartney for 45 years. And he's just recently retired from working with Paul. And he's one of my dearest old mates. So he and his wife and me and my ex were there together. I was in the, you know, they had it in three theatres.
Yeah.
We were in the second, not the main one. There was one off to the, whatever that was, you know. Right.
So I haven't seen the Sid Barrett doc. It's coming out soon, I know. What did you guys think of it? Guy, what did you think?
I thought it was great. Jerry should go first.
No, you go first, because I've got a story to tell you about what happened with me. But anyway, go ahead. What did you think?
All right. I thought it was great. I thought it was really, really good. And I loved hearing Storm's interjections from behind the camera. But then that's what made it slightly weird, was seeing everyone interviewed like 10, 15 years ago.
So
it's like a new film with a sort of new perspective, but everyone's a bit younger.
Long in the making. And Storm has died since then.
Well, but some of us were, some of us weren't. I mean, he started it, as you probably know, but then he got sick and sadly passed away.
Yeah.
But one of his dying wishes were that they finished it, and they finished it in the manner that he started it. They came to interview me, and I had just had my hips replaced not long before. So I was still recovering from that. And I had, before that, done an interview many years before for the BBC about Sid. And I'd forgotten that they'd come down to interview me down here in Cornwall, mainly because I'd just come out of hospital weeks before, and I was kind of still, you know, still learning to walk, really. Anyway, it started to come back to me that, yes, I remembered them being here and that, but I didn't remember much. I said, how long did I talk for? You know, and they said, oh, we've got about an hour and a half. Really? I said, well, you're not going to use all of it. I said, no. I said, well, how much are you going to use? Said, oh, about 30 seconds. So I said, okay, that's great. You know, that same applied to everybody, really. But as it got closer to the bit where I knew my bit had been coming up, because it went chronologically, my ex, bless her, she starts to doze off a little bit. So I turned and my picture came up on the screen, and I turned to kind of go, wake up, dear. Look back, and I was gone. That was it.
Then you were gone.
Oh, apparently I mentioned Willie Wilson, bless him, and that was it. I didn't actually see, I only saw a tiny bit of the small bit that was in there, which was fine. I mean, I didn't go there to see my bit. I went there to see the whole thing, and I thought,
yes, you did. We all do. Yeah. We all do.
Yeah, and I thought it was brilliantly done. I thought it portrayed Sid the way he should have been portrayed, as a lovely man that he actually was. I didn't know him before the fire, if you like. You know, I knew him after the fire. And
that's a sweet way of putting it.
Well, it's a fact. And so I would get glimpses of the old Sid, except they would happen in strange ways. As an example, he was my going to the speakeasy buddy, except Sid's way of going to the speakeasy, all dressed to kill, you know, looking cool, because Sid still looked cool then, you know, in 1971. except his eyes had gotten to that sort of dark, you know, what's the line from the song, the dark holes in the whatever. But he still, you know, was dressed good, and he was Sid Barrett, you know, he had presence. So he'd turn up at me and Willie's flat on Redcliffe Gardens, ready to go to the speakeasy, except it was 8 o'clock in the morning. Oh, okay, Sid, well, come in.
What time did it open?
11 o'clock. Yeah. So I didn't start, the speak didn't start getting going till 11 and went until, I don't know, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 sometimes, I think.
But, so he'd lost track of time completely at that
well,
point.
Well, yeah, I mean, and so we would say, okay, come on in, you know, and then we would do what, you know, 1970 hippies would do. We'd sit around all day, you know, rolling joints, smoking tea, listening to music, and he'd be perfectly normal. He never had any money on him, ever. Never, you know, so we'd drive him to the speakeasy, and I think because he was with us or because I'd started to become known at that point a little bit, I'm not sure, we were let in for nothing, so we didn't have to worry about paying to get in. But once we were in there, we bought him his drink, something. But the main thing was that he would be perfectly normal going there. But as soon as he went in, and bearing in mind it was his idea to go, he just shut off. As soon as he walked in, as soon as he was faced wow. with people, with the business, you know, with the place he wanted to go to, that was it. He would just shut down. He was just staring into the middle distance, and you couldn't get a word out of him until such time as it was time to go. And we'd drive him home, and then 8 o'clock the next morning.
Who was in the speakeasy when you were there? What sort of celebrities were around?
Everybody, just about. It was divided into three areas. There was the restaurant. As you walked into the place, there was the bar and places to sit. Bar to left, places to sit and stand right in front of you. Then directly in front of you, there was the restaurant that was had glass windows but was closed off from the rest of the club. Then you walked around the corner and there was the main music part where the live music was played on a stage at the end of that piece of the... and then at the far end, back near the entrance, was the other part of the bar. My best experience there that kept my feet firmly on the ground was with Ginger Baker years before when I was, I think I must have been about 15 at the time. I was doing sessions for Immediate Records for Steve Marriott. I'd had a lot of compliments while I was doing these sessions by Steve. He used to show me off to all these big shot friends of his. Right, I'd be doing a drum check.
You're a few years younger than everyone.
Yeah, at this point, I'm talking about 66, 67. I was 14, 15. And everybody that Steve's showing me off to, the people like Mick Jagger and Charlie Watts and Jimi Hendrix, were all in their 20s already, late 20s, some maybe. Mm-mm. But they were all very, very sweet to me, you know, and I was very shy. He'd do the same thing every time. I'd be doing a drum check with Vin Johns or Eddie Kramer doing the sound. I'd have my head down, and of course, they were getting great drum sounds, but I was in Studio B. Anyway, so I'd have my head down and bang, glass, wallop, you know, and then they'd say, right, come listen. And I'd look up, and there'd be Steve Marriott, Mick Jagger, and Charlie Watts. That was a one time, and I just wanted the ground to swallow me up. I was so, yeah, I mean, 14, and there's your heroes, and I'm in back. And I'm not very tall now, but I was a lot shorter then. So anyway, I get off the drum kit, and I walk towards him, and Charlie came over to me, put his arm around me, and he said, that's enough to make me want to cut my wrists off. And now, wow. he didn't have to say something like that, and it's not true, because he was just by far and away the greatest groove drummer. I mean, Charlie's backbeat was just, and his snare drum sound was the best in the business. Always was, always will be. You know, may he rest in peace. And when Hendrix was the one, what he did was a similar thing. He's because they could see I was just shy and nervous and stuff. And Hendrix said, "Well, man," he said, "that's really cool. That's really cool." So I go to the speakeasy.
That's enough from Jimmy.
And the little band I was in at the time were playing, and we hadn't played very well. And I'm looking out at the bar, and there's Ginger Baker. So I thought, okie dokie. Now, I get off the stage, and you had to walk past to get to the dressing room. You had to walk past where he was to get there. So I'm walking along, trying, keep my head up. And as I get level with him, he's leaning very Ginger Baker-like against the bar. And as I walk past him, he looks at me and says, just when my head's getting, a little bit sort of, oh, I'm doing good here. And he looks straight at me and says, "Fucking shit."
God.
So thank him, may he rest in peace, for keeping my feet firmly on the ground.
Wow.
You said, "I wasn't that tall then, and I'm a bit taller now." So you're not even grown up.
What now or then?
Then you're still like a child growing up.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was still going.
A massive Small Faces fan, weren't you, Jerry?
Yeah.
Did you have an incident where you bumped into Steve Marriott early on?
Yeah, that's how it all started. It all started by seeing them on Ready, Steady, Go, and I couldn't believe watching Kenny. It was like watching me. You know, he had the same drum kit. I just managed to save up enough money for a deposit on a silver glitter super classic Ludwig kit, which was what he had. And I didn't know he had. I had never seen him before. Mm-hmm. And his playing style was exactly like mine. And, of course, because they were the sort of king mods, we suddenly became even more moddy than we were already becoming. And we became like most bands did at the time, which was a Small Faces copy band.
Your name very much alluded to that, didn't it?
At one point, yeah. When you mean when we were the little people?
The little people.
that you can't get any more alluding to being a Small Faces copy band.
Right.
Anyway, we played a gig supporting them. And my dad was helping the guy promote the show, I think. And he went into their dressing room and very politely. My dad was just the greatest. It was him that got me started. But anyway, he went in and introduced himself and just said, "Would you mind having a look at my son? He's playing in the band for you because he's a huge fan of yours and it would mean a lot to me and it would be a lot to him." And so I don't know this is going on. And I'm on stage playing and we're doing all the Tamla Motown hits. We had to take our Small Faces jackets off. We couldn't support them and be looking like them something. I turn to the left and I look in the wings and there's Kenny Jones going like this.
Thumbs up.
Wow. Now, at this point, I was just turned 14, I think. Then, minutes later, I look again, and there's him and Steve Marriott both going like this. So after the show, they came up to me and said, "That was fantastic. You're really doing great." And jokingly, well, I didn't know, I went away thinking it might one day happen, but jokingly said, "If Kenny ever gets sick, you could be standing." And I went, "Oh, wow," So I'm getting all this tapping on the back. And again, I thank Ginger Baker for keeping me on the ground. But that's how we first met him. Then we met Steve on Shaftesbury Avenue. He was in Drum City looking at something, and we were just looking in the shop window and saw him in there and just went in and reintroduced ourselves. I think it was our keyboard player said to him, "Don't suppose you could record a single for us, could you?" He was one of those guys,
I bet Steve looked immaculate. I'm trying to picture this as well.
Steve at this point is the best dressed guy in the world. He's just, in fact, I can remember literally what he was wearing that day. He had this fabulous, it was a typical kind of mod style jacket. And then he had a waistcoat that was made of the same material, but it was double breasted, kind of like a Western cowboy type of waistcoat, with a white shirt, black mohair strides, beautifully cut, and a pair of white pumps, sneakers. And he just, not only did he look $1 million, you know, his hair was just cool, and he smelled like $1 million, you know, because they all were really into being immaculate in the way that they dressed. Until the 67-ish, when they turned into hippies, that's when all that kind of went in. They still dressed well, but it wasn't quite as immaculate, shall we say.
Well, yeah, I always find that quite funny with all those people who were like such fantastic kind of dandies, whatever, and mods in the 60s, where everything just became denim.
Yeah, it did. It went a bit. I mean, you guys.
They went through their, some of them went through their peacock era, didn't they? Sort of, King's Road look. And some of those either went denim, like Marriott did, or glam, like Bowie did. You know, there was definitely Mark Boland. So there was, I'm just seeing this.
Or white boiler suit and boots, like
exactly. So good. So let's talk about how you ended up. Because you were introduced to Angelou Golden, weren't you, at Immediate Records?
Yeah, he was great. He was he again was immaculately dressed, smelt like $1 million, and probably had $1 million at the time.
Well, no, he always said when we had him on here and he was fantastic, but he said about money, he said, well, I was either wearing it or drinking it.
or driving it or being driven in it.
Or drive.
Yeah, he had some fantastic cars. He was the first guy I ever knew to have one of those old single players that you could have in your car. So it played a single, you know, a 45.
Vinyl.
Any 45 you liked, you just slipped it into his machine and it played it. But he had it so that the sound was like Phil Spector, big sound in the back of this Rolls Royce Phantom limousine. It was just fantastic. So, yeah, he did either wear it or drink it, that's for sure.
But he changed your name and it was like, what?
He changed it to... We were going to be called The Nice, and Steve wanted us to be called The Nice, and Andrew said no and pinched it for at Arnold's band, which, of course, was...
Keith Emerson, The Nice.
Keith Emerson, The Nice, yeah, Keith Emerson and the guys. Yeah. Shame, because it was a much nicer name. So Andrew comes up with, you're going to be called The Apostolic Intervention. And we all went, oh, okay, but it meant we got a single out. You know, it did nothing, but
Great single, great single.
It's a mod classic, isn't it?
And we started to get a little bit of a following, you know, and
Steve wrote a single, didn't he? Have You Ever Seen Me?
Steve and Ronnie. I think it was actually might have been more of a Ronnie song than a Steve, because the night.
Ronnie Lane.
Yeah, Ronnie Lane, because the night we did it, Ronnie came along originally as one of the two producers, but he left in a bit of a huff. I don't think he wanted us to do it for his own reasons. But Steve, bless his heart, he stuck with it, and we did the session, did it at IBC, got a great sound for the day, and may he rest in peace, our then bass player, bottled. He just couldn't hold his nerve together. So Steve jumps in and plays bass. And we get it in the first or second take. A couple of overdubs, put some timps on it, I think, and some maybe a harpsichord, mixed it, and it was done. And then we had to do a B-side that we wrote, my brother and the keyboard player wrote, and it was an instrumental. It was like a Booker T rip-off, you know. And Steve also produced that, and you can hear him in the background singing the odd line and playing a bit of lead guitar too. He was so kind to us. He really was. He was great.
Your life gets back with Steve later, but I think I'd really like to know how it was recording with Syd Barrett, because that was produced... Am I right, Guy? Were they both produced by David Gilmour?
No, the first one was David and Roger, and the second one was David with Rick.
That's
helping
right.
out, wasn't it?
Yep.
What was it like playing with Syd on those... Because you don't play on all the... I think you play on two tracks on the first album, Madcap Laughs, yep. and then you play on a lot more, don't you, on the second album.
That's
and,
right.
Just give us a précis of what the experience of being with Syd is like in a studio.
Interesting, maddening, a nightmare, a privilege, all at the same, rolled into one ball.
And were you friends of David's, or was it Syd who got you in?
Yeah. I'd already met David when he had just got the gig with Pink Floyd when I was working in Cambridge with Tim Renick, the band that Tim Renick. So he came round to visit the band house we had in the outskirts of Cambridge. And two of the members of the band had worked, one of the members, the bass player, Rick Wills, had worked with Dave. And of course, Tim knew him from growing up in Cambridge. And he actually came round one day, and I think, yeah, he ended up producing a demo for us, which nothing ever happened with. That's where I first got to know Dave. Then, within a year of him having the Floyd gig, I got Humble Pie gig. And then we both moved into the same area of London where Willie was already living, Willie Wilson, and all around the Redcliffe Gardens area. And
But did Syd come in with fully formed songs, and yeah, did you all play them together?
Yeah, to answer you, about the experience of what it was like as a musician, was a drummer, you never knew which end it was going to be up. We had three ways of doing it. First was all, and this is quite a band if you think about it, playing as a four-piece, me on drums, Dave Gilmour on bass, Richard Wright on keyboards, Syd Barrett on lead guitar, and singing.
Wow.
And we actually did a few of the songs live like that. The one in particular, and I think the only one that we got all the way through, is Gigolo Aunt. Then the other way of doing it was David bringing Syd into the studio and having Syd record the song, whatever it was, like, for instance, Baby Lemonade, with just him singing and playing guitar. And David would take it away and learn it up here, because at the time, I don't know if he does now, but I don't believe he read music at that.
He learned to read music so he could do saxophone lessons with his son.
Right.
But not for his music.
Right,
no.
Exactly. And then that was years later. Back then, we were all ears music, all ears players. But anyway, so he would learn it, and they'd play it to me through the cans, and Dave would stand in front of me and conduct me, because he's listening as well, and he knows it off by heart. So it's... Ooh, baby, lemonade, up a bit, down a bit, over to the left a bit, you know, slow down a bit, speed up a bit, you know. I mean, literally conducting the tempo to me, with anticipating where it's going to go.
Based on Syd's acoustic.
Based on what Syd's already put down on a track.
Because Domino's is you, isn't it?
Yeah, Domino's is the best track on the album, and that was done. That's not me. That's the best.
Oh, that's not you. I thought that
was.
I wish, because
it's my favourite. That's Dave. That's David playing drums, again overdubbed on what was put together with Syd. You know, previously David was so patient with Syd through the whole thing. You know, it took sometimes hours to get one take out of him, whether it was all of us together or him on his own. On, as an example, on the first album, I seem to remember, and I'm not saying this as a put-down or anything like that, just I remember Roger kind of having enough, sort of saying, I just can't do this anymore. And David finishing it off. And then very soon thereafter, the second album was to be made, and Rick Wright came in and took over. And he hung in there through the whole thing. May he rest in peace.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out. I was listening to some of those albums today, and the connection that I made in my mind was Noel Coward. There's something very Noel Coward about Sid's lyrics and his whimsy. I mean, especially something like Effervescing Elephant or something. You know, you can imagine that as a Coward song.
Well, or a Spike Milligan, Chilterns.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. He had that very English side of his writing that few people have, that those two in particular we just mentioned. It's interesting that you bring up Noel Coward, because he's a hero of mine, but he was also a hero of Steve Marriott's. It was Steve that turned me on to Noel Coward and all his books, written, you know, his biographies and autobiographies and bits of hilariously funny man.
Gary's actually just reread his biography.
Yeah, I have. Yes.
That's why he's at the front of his brain.
Yeah, it is. I think we should get on to Humble Pie, don't you, Guy?
Go ahead.
Yes, how did you? I mean, this was called a supergroup, wasn't it? I mean, that was because it was Peter Frampton from The Herd and Steve Marriott from The Small Faces, and at the beginning, Ian was going to play keyboards in the band, wasn't he?
For 5 minutes.
right.
What happened was Steve offered him a sort of olive branch, I suppose. You know, hey, why don't you come down and rehearse with us and see if you like it. And we did one of his songs on the first album. But there was a problem that went back to Greg used to date...
Greg Ridley, bass player.
Greg Ridley used to date the lady that became Sandy Sargent, who became Matt's first wife. She was one of the dancers on Ready, Steady, Go. And there was, you know, something going on there that just didn't quite... And I think Matt didn't feel right about deserting his two mates. If Steve had left, if he'd have left too, and you know, it was a very weird time. And I don't think it would have worked because I just don't think it would have worked. See, in theory, yes, but in practice, I don't think...
But the spawning of the Small Faces into two supergroups. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it did turn out good for everybody, didn't it? I mean, when it first happened, I said to Steve the night he called me and said, I want to join your band because Peter and I were already working on putting a band together.
Oh.
You know, months before that famous night when Steve walked off stage at the Alley Pally, Steve had introduced me to Peter because Peter was looking for a drummer who played like Kenny. So Steve said, I know the very guy. And called me. I went down to meet Peter at Steve's cottage, Beehive Cottage. And then Peter came up literally the next day, I think, to see me play with the band I was in with Tim Rennick in Cambridge. And he offered to drive me back after the gig to the band house and offered me the gig. And he said, I'd like you to be my drummer. I'd love you playing. And
that was going to be the Peter Frampton band, was it? Or the people?
Yeah, that would have been whatever. You know, he was very sweet about it. It was going to be our band. You know, yes, it was Peter Frampton's band, but he treated it and the way he treated me as we were putting a band together, bless his heart. Unless that was just my youth seeing it that way, but that's the way he was treating it.
Ginger Baker wouldn't have gone that way, I don't think, no.
No. I think Ginger Baker would have... anyway. Then, out of nowhere, on New Year's Eve 1968, going into 69, Peter and I both get phone calls within minutes of each other from Steve Marriott saying, hello, mate, I've just quit the Small Faces. Can I join your band? Peter never says this, but it did happen. Peter's version is, yes, he says, yes, of course, that'd be great. Lovely. And that is true. That's what we said. But what we initially said was, no, you can't do that. You can't lead the Small Faces. You're nuts. And he was made up his mind. He'd had enough. He said, no, I'm done. It's over. And if you knew Steve, once he'd made up his mind, there was no changing it. So... then it was like, with me, what the cream, the icing on the cake was, he said, by the way, I've got a bass player wants to come along, Greg Ridley from Spooky Tooth. Now, he was my favourite bass player. He was just...
he's fantastic. You two together on Rockin' the Fillmore. Mate.
Absolutely. He helped. You would know. He helped almost invent that type of bass playing at that time. There wasn't a lot of people playing a sort of an Americanized, you know, Motown-ish.
Yeah. Fantastically musical. Lots of dusty ends. Really great.
Yeah, I mean, he had
a singer as well.
What a singer. Yeah. That was the thing. When we had our first rehearsals, that hit me, apart from we immediately hit a groove, a backbeat like I'd never experienced, just fat, fat backbeat. But then when they started to sing together, like, wow, you know, I was in heaven. I'd just joined the greatest band in the world. Except so had Steve Stills and Dave Crosby and Graham Nash and... Ginger Baker, Eric Clapton, Steve Winwood. I mean, there was about five or six or more of those, you know, named
supergroups.
Supergroup. Yeah. But the thing about the supergroup thing was, I always say, yeah, we were called a supergroup, and at the time they said, Steve Marriott of the Small Faces, Peter Frampton, Heard, Greg Ridley, Spooky Tooth, and Jerry Shirley?
Of the apostolic intervention.
Yeah, for the apostolic intervention.
Of the Spanish Inquisition.
You know. Steve shared all this. They did share the singing around because you sang on one of the Humble Pie tracks as well, didn't you, Shep?
Yeah, I did. Embarrassingly so. Yes, I did. I can write songs, not that many, but I can't sing them. When your voice goes south, when you get to about 10 or 11, 12, whatever, and you go from singing up there to singing down there. And I lost my voice. It never developed once that's part of our anatomy that dropped. Once my nuts went south, so did my voice. I couldn't sing well anymore. And
take us back though to when you those nights at the Fillmore. That tour was like.
We played there prior to the night that we recorded it. We'd played there, I think, 24 shows. We were the go-to band whenever there was a band who fell out for some reason. You know, they couldn't show up. Someone got sick, whatever. We had some of the shows that were all pre-booked. We knew we were going to do. But then we'd be 100 miles away, maybe in Philadelphia or somewhere, and we'd get a call. Quick, Bill Graham needs a band. Off we'd go and sit in. I think Jethro Tull was one that fell out, so we were there. This happened a lot. So by the time we got to play the night that we did the live album, it was at the end of a 10-week tour. So we were tight as a duck's behind. And you know how that goes, guys. When you've been on the road that long, the longer you're out there, the tighter the band gets. But it was perfect because we developed a following at the Fillmore. And it all went on the tape beautifully. We weren't headliners that night, by the way. The night that was recorded, we were second on the bill. Lee Michaels was the headliner.
Wow, I didn't know that.
That's a lot of people don't.
No, because it's not something you'd think to do. Is do a live album when you're supporting, because you know you want your audience.
Well, right? That's the thing. They were. We apparently sold 70% of the tickets. That's our bigger following we'd got in the Fillmore. You know, we were the go see band at the Fillmore by that point.
Were you doing two shows a night?
Yeah, two shows a night over two nights, so four shows over each time you appeared there. And like I say, it added up with us to a total of 26 shows. From the very first time we played their opening for Santana till the last time when we recorded the album. And we nearly screwed the album up entirely when we mixed it because of our inexperience of mixing live albums. We mixed out all the ambient mics. We treated it like it was a studio album. The audience and all that beautiful room sound, we got, for some unknown reason, we just didn't, you know, inexperienced. Our manager came and heard it and said, "What have you done? Where's the audience? You ruined it." It's, you know, so we took the tapes to America and had Eddie Kramer mix it at Electric Ladyland. And of course, Eddie had a lot of experience with recording live. And to be honest, Peter did most of the, you know, it was a sort of a too many cooks thing. So we didn't want the whole band there all the time getting in the way. And Peter would be the main guy that would go and sit with Eddie. And if it wasn't Peter, it would be Steve. And if it wasn't Steve, it would be all four of us. So, but to give him credit, Peter was the one that went out of his way to be the representative. But, that doesn't mean to say we were never there. I was there a lot. It was just amazing the difference when someone who knew that were doing all that beautiful live ambient sound that was in that room happened to be the best sounding room in America.
Because what was the Fillmore like? Because we hear so much about it. I've never really known what it was. Was it a theatre? Was it a ballroom?
It was a theatre not dissimilar to the Rainbow, something like that. You know, maybe a little smaller, better sounding. But yeah, somewhere like the what was the Astoria that became the Rainbow.
What's amazing about Humble Pie at that period is the homage they play to American black music. Is, you know, because, you know, that we're at that time, you know, there were a lot of people getting their heads together in Laurel Canyon, and, you know, there was much more of a rock sound generally, but this was much more, you know, I mean, you were playing tracks by Ike and Tina Turner, you know, I'm Ready and Black Coffee, and is later on, obviously, but, you know, Ray Charles, Hallelujah, I Just Love Her So, you know, with that fantastic swing that you do on that track, Jerry. But you know, Steve's respect for black music, and in fact, bringing in the Blackberries as well, which had the singer from Ike and Tina Turner's band, you know, and incorporating them. I remember, Guy, you must have seen Black Coffee on the Old Grey Whistle Test.
Yeah, the Old Grey Whistle Test, where it's a legendary.
See you in, Jerry. You're lost behind everybody.
All you see is a little bit of hi hat. And that's it. It's such a tiny room, that the original room, that we recorded two tracks. We recorded Black Coffee, and we recorded a version of Twist and Shout with Vanetta Fields, the Ikette, doing the lead vocal. And on that, you can see me just about. But on Black Coffee, one of the best live things we did on TV, you can't see me at all, which is a perfect sort of drummer thing to happen. You know what I mean?
Welcome to my world, mate.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
the only time I ever get a camera is during the guitar solo.
Drums and bass.
Going back to my point, you know, you were embracing black music quite heavily, and that was being Americans. Got that? I mean, that was coming from Steve, I guess, wasn't it? You know, growing up as mods, listening to Tamla Motown.
Well, we all four of us came from backgrounds that were steeped in the same influences. That was the main thing, that we all loved Booker T and the MGs. We all loved Tamla Motown. We all loved Ray Charles live in his famous 1959 live album recorded in Atlanta. On one mic, I might add, and it sounds beautiful. We all loved Aretha. We all loved all those, you know, Otis Blue, all that great Stax Motown stuff before Humble Pie. That's what we had in common. And then when the band came out with their take on being in a soulful type band of their own, that affected us a lot. And then if you put it all in the mixer, and out comes this British version of American soul and R&B and blues. And it all, I suppose, culminated in at its best on the Fillmore album, certainly. There's another live album that we did as a King Biscuit Flower Hour broadcast the year later with the Blackberries, that was released to a lesser degree, but is still us at our best. It's like the Fillmore is us at our best with Peter, and this one at the Winterland is us at our best with Clem Clempson on guitar and the Blackberries singing with us. Because don't forget, the Blackberries also had a Raylette in them. Clyde King, may she rest in peace, was one of them. So we had a Raylette, an Ikette, and Billy Barnum, who was their friend, who was also a great singer.
From the circus.
You know, again, all through this, I'm 19 years old at the Fillmore.
Oh,
I'm
God.
20 to 21 years old at the Winterland, and there's all these people around me who gave me such encouragement, treated me as an equal, didn't kind of put me down or make me feel like, well, you're just a kid or anything like that. And I owe them a great deal because of that.
Jerry, on the Humble Pie album, the third studio album you made, the track I'm Ready on that, you begin, Your drumming is phenomenal.
Well, thank you. it always amazes me that people like what I did. Wow.
Well, you were very good. That's why, Jerry. But because you have the distinction of you're the one person who was in every incarnation of Humble Pie.
Yeah.
Like Nick Mason.
Yeah. I suppose. I've met Nick so many times, but I've never really got to know him. You know, no reason why not. I just David was always my mate.
Well, you took his job on that Sid album, didn't you? That's why.
Maybe. I don't think so. No.
Well, I still remember we were having a great night with you in Cleveland back in 94.
That's right. Yes, we did. You guys got me up on the stage on soundcheck, didn't you? Do you remember that?
That's right. Yes, that's right.
To surprise David. Because I was working for the radio station in Cleveland at the time.
You were a DJ.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the biggest station in town were really jealous that I was getting all these scoops, like going to the McCartney show and getting an interview with Paul because of my friend John Hamill, who worked for Paul, and then coming to interview David, and then there. The other station are all in the stadium while you're sound checking, watching what's going on, and you guys bring me up on stage without David seeing what was happening and said, I didn't know you were going to do it. And you said, hey, come on, get up on the other drummer's kit. And I'm suddenly sitting there on this drum kit I've never played before. It was bigger than me, you know, but and then Dave could tell the groove had changed a little bit. You know, maybe that sounds familiar. I don't know. But then he turned round and saw me. Big smile on his face. Oh, dear.
Jerry, you have a great book out. Do you want to just plug it for a second?
The book's called...
What a title. I love the title.
The Best Seat in the House.
That's a great title.
Well, that came out by accident. The title happened by accident because the title I was originally going to use... was I used to be a rock star, but I'm all right now. And they said, you know, they said yes, but no. Because and I said, well, how about, I don't know, the best seat in the house? Because it was by far the best seat in the house. There's a number of books with that title, but I think it's the only one about music.
By a drummer.
Thankfully, I managed to snag it before any other drummer, I guess. But I'm proud of that book just because it started because my hips went south and I couldn't play. And so all I could do was sit and write. I had never used a typewriter or a computer before. This is back in 2008, 2009, around there. I was completely unconnected to the computer world or typing at all. And I sat there for a couple of years on and off and wrote 600 pages, and, you know, just kept writing and writing and writing. And, of course, that had to be chopped down to sellable amount. And it did quite well, considering. I mean, it's just little me. It's not Ginger Baker.
Great stories, though. I mean, you know, you've worked with two, I mean, sadly no longer with us, two of the great, great people in this business, Sid and Stevie Marriott.
Yeah.
Oh, there's also some John Entwistle's album.
That's right. Yeah, I did that when I was...
His first solo
really?
Album. Yeah.
I was 18 when I did that. Yeah. And
Wow. He's a monster to play with. But actually, funnily enough, I mean, you must have loved Keith anyway, so it must have been a great honour for you.
Well, Keith and I had become mates anyway because, again, our band used to open up for the Who a lot. And Keith was, you know, everybody's friend. He was one of those guys that once you met him for 5 minutes, you'd known him for 2 minutes, he was your best mate. And he was always very kind to me. And on those sessions, my kit had been left in America because we were on a break and it didn't pay to bring all the kit, all the equipment home to only then turn around and take it back again. It was easier to leave it in America, go home for a break, So I didn't have a kit. I had to go to Drum City to hire a kit. Now, back in the day, Drum City were a bunch of snobs to us lesser-known drummers. Keith knew this because he went through it before he was well-known. So I get there the day of the beginning of the sessions, and the one thing I asked for, I wanted it to be a Ludwig kit, but I said, as long as it's got a speaking pedal, that's all I ask. This is me talking to Drum City. And of course, they send it and there's no speaking pedal. So Keith comes on the first day to wish everybody well and help us start opening the bar, which was on the top of the grand piano. The grand piano was a bar, the entire top of it. He could see I was a little bit down. He said, what's the matter? I said, well, it's Drum City. They've sent this kit over, and this horrible, God knows what, pedal. And all I asked him, he got on the phone, and he ripped into them. And within 10 minutes, there was a brand new speaking drum pedal delivered to Trident Studios by Drum City. Thank you, Keith Moon. And it was, yeah, those sessions, they were all done in 5 days, I think. We completed the whole album, the backtracks, in 5 days, and it was mixed. And my mother was passing away as we were doing it. It was a very heavy time for me. And we finished the tracks on a Friday night, and we had to go back on Monday just to check a few things and this and that. I went to visit her at Carlo Hospital on Saturday, and as I'm walking into the hospital, my auntie, her sister, comes running out of her room, screaming, crying. And of course, I realized she, you know, again, I'm 17, 18 years old. And I got to walk into the room to see her draw her last breath. And it was just unbelievably, you know, you can only imagine what that was like. I had to go back on the Monday to the studio. And the agreement was that I was going to get paid a handsome £150 for the sessions, and John was going to pay himself and the guitar player £300. He gives me a check.
John Edwards will play himself for his own album.
Yeah, yeah, because he was financing it, and,
oh, I see.
You know, that's how it went. So anyway, he gives me an envelope for my check. I open it up, and it's not £150, it's the same as him, it's £300. And all he said was, he said, I thought this might help given the circumstances.
Oh,
because, yeah, that's very sweet. Because it's, especially because it's a very macabre album to be working on at that.
Well, yeah.
Because, of course, with John, there's a lot of very dark. And it was, the engineer was a young Roy Thomas Baker,
yeah.
I believe, wasn't it?
Yeah. I didn't mean to lower the tone there, I just, but the truth is that, you know, that's what happened. You know?
Jerry, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, it's been great.
I mean, really amazing insights, touchstones into like such incredible moments with the Floyd and Speakeasy, and with Humble Pie. And I think we passed through Mick Jagger and Jimi Hendrix as well, didn't we?
Yeah, I think we got in there.
Yeah. In passing, yeah.
Can I just tell you one quick thing about the going into Abbey Road years later?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I was, you know, those rock and roll camp things they do where they get people together.
Yeah.
Well, I was sitting in on one of those helping out Mick Ralphs because he could only do a couple of days and he was booked for four. So I sat in for Mick, and it involved going to Abbey Road with the band that you'd been given to try and mentor. And as I'm walking in, this is after Rick and Sid have both passed away. It was about 2008, 2009. And on the one pillar of the two pillars in the gateway to Abbey Road, there was graffiti. Yeah. And on the one side, it said, "We love you, Rick Wright. May you rest in peace." And on the other one, "We love you, Sid Barrett. May you rest in peace." And as I'm walking in, I realize, wait a minute, 46 or whatever it was years before, I'd been walking in there to play with these two guys and David.
Yeah.
You know, it was just such a beautiful moment. poignant, I think, is what the word would be.
Wow.
I'm very lucky, very, very lucky man to have had those experiences.
Well, you've certainly had the experiences, Jay. There's no question of that. And, you know, and you deserve to, mate. You're a brilliant driver.
Thank you so much. I mean, it's an honour to have met you. And, you know, you've been in my life for many years, many decades, Jerry.
Well,
we still play those tracks. We still play those albums.
I'm thrilled to know that you guys, your generation, were listening to us, you know, because there's quite a difference between the sound of Spandau Ballet and the sound of Humble Pie. And
yeah, but do you know what? It's funny because all of us were into that album in that band. And when we toured in the 80s, we were always playing that. John Keeble, our drummer, especially loved it, you know, and my brother and me. I mean, it was Steve Norman. It was a big record in our, I mean, you know, I think it's one of the greatest live albums ever made, isn't it?
Thank you. And you guys, it seemed to me like you took where the mods were and took it to another level, you know, and some beautiful, and you've written some seriously good songs there, my son.
Oh, thanks, Jerry. Listen, if we're in Cornwall, we should meet up.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime, you're welcome.
Well, that was our sort of target rock on tours era, wasn't it, really?
It kind of was, wasn't it? Yeah. I would say we have two target areas, which is that, exactly that, him and all the rooms he was in, and the 80s.
Yeah, 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 yeah. So it's the speakeasy or it's the Blitz,
speakeasy or the
rum runner.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Limelight.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I mean, the thing is about Jerry, he's a humble man, literally, as well. But
he hasn't eaten all the pies, though.
Yes. But it was just that moment of that kid, through the kid's eyes, of being there with Ginger Baker, of being there when Jimmy and Mick and Charlie and all these names that are historic legends to us, you know. It's the joy of doing this programme. It's of talking to these people.
Absolutely.
And getting their stories down on tape, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. To be preserved for future generations.
Yes. Ian, our producer for today, because Ben's away, has apparently got a Sid story.
That's right.
Ian, are you there?
Ian's going to tell us all about it.
Okay, guys. Well, my old boss, Nick Baraclough, who got me into this business of music and radio and stuff, his sister, Alison, went to school with Sid in Cambridge. And on the very last day of school, Sid gave her his marbles. And also, apparently, Sid once kissed a girl at school, does this snog, and the whole playground turned out to watch it. There was an audience surrounding this couple having a schoolyard kiss. So Sid was a star at 11 or something like that.
Well, there it is. You heard. That's another Rock on Tour scoop.
Yes. How Sid lost his marbles or gave them away.
He gave them away.
Willingly. Thank you, Ian. Thank you. Now go away. There's something we have to say, isn't there, Guy?
Yes, of course. We do now offer, we've launched Rock on Tours Extra, which you can sign up for. And then you'll get extra bonus episodes, you know, including some of the specials we've done, like on Andy Rourke and David Crosby. And you get extra video content. Who have we got on video, Gary?
We've got Stuart Copeland out there. We've got Paul Simonon. There's some stuff from there will be some stuff from the Screen on the Green special that we did, our first live show. And we'll keep doing that. So we'll also, you can get to ask questions and you can also get to hear about live events that are up and coming before anyone else.
Exactly. So sign up today.
Yes. Well, that's it, isn't it, for this show?
That's it for this show. It was a great one. He's a lovely. He loves the chat. He's a sweet man, isn't he?
Sweet man. I'm going to go off and play more Humble Pie and Rocking the Fillmore and eat it. And I'm not going to eat the album. I'm not going to eat Humble Pie.
No, no. Well, although perhaps one of these days. So anyway, it's good night from me.
Good night from them.
Rock on Tours is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions. The Warner Music Group UK.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.